This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It is July 26, 2017. Where did the summer go? Oh, I don't want to talk about that yet. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's got it going on. A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can call or text at 860-486-9487. The lovely Fran is standing by. Or email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Or you can also visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past podcast episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute to the or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Okay, starting out the show this week with On a Positive Side. So, you know, I'm always ranting about cars and people that drive them and trucks and people that drive them, but I'm going to do a shout out to people who drive cars and trucks that are nice to cyclists. So I've just had a couple of really nice experiences recently while I was out riding my bike, and, you know, it was just a really super thing where the people, it's all about communication. You know, you look at a driver as you're approaching an intersection and you just, you know, kind of, sometimes you wave at them. Sometimes you just point in the direction you're going and catch their attention, and you'll see a quick wave behind the steering wheel. I had a great encounter with a pickup truck this past weekend where I indicated that we were bearing off to the left, and sometimes, you know, people don't let them know what's going on, and he gave me a big wave and a thumbs up when I went by. So people who drive cars and trucks that are nice to cyclists, big, big shout out there. That's a really beautiful thing. So, moving forward, we have, or maybe backwards, Ron's Rant of the Week, the annual Rant of the Week. And this one, this week, comes from, and they may be listening today, they usually are, my friends Sarah and John from Massachusetts. And I thank them very much for this. When I was at the last Farm to Fork Fondo up in Vermont, they were there, and they came up, and they were telling me how much they loved listening to the show, which is really cool. Thank you so much. And they said, we've got a rant for you. And they kid around now around the house, and they talk about different rants that they're going to have. So anyway, this rant is from Sarah and John. And this is, if you're in a big, like an organized ride, let's say like Farm to Fork or any other ride where you're on a big group ride, and you get riders who climb up upon you, or they latch onto you on a group ride, they sit on your wheel for 5 or 10 minutes, and then after sucking your wheel, they attack hard and leave you behind without contributing to the effort that you are putting out. What is with that? Come on, folks. Don't be so darn rude. That's a crazy thing. So I have had this happen to me more times than not, where I have been just cruising along, taking a pretty hard pull, helping people out, you know, especially people that who have felt like, you know, you could tell that they were starting to flag on a ride, and they're in trouble and they need to sit on a wheel. I have no problem with you sitting on my wheel. No problem whatsoever. I'm very happy to tow you. But then once you have felt like you're feeling your oats and things are good, to then launch an attack and sprint ahead to the point where I can't hop on your wheel because I've been pulling your butt for the last, 10 or 15 miles. Don't do that. That's just rude. That's bicycle etiquette 101 here. Come on. You must know better than do that. So don't do that. Don't do that. So big thanks to Sarah and John for that, because they're absolutely right. That just infuriates me. And it certainly was a good rant. So thank you so much. Moving from there, last week's rant became last week's show, and last week's rant was on the Oregon bike tax. And, you know, I'm not the only one who's upset by this, and I'm going to go directly to my good old League of American Bicyclists, who is, they are a large organization that is, basically they're the bicycle advocacy group of the country, and they have lots of interesting things. If you want to know more about them, go to bikeleague.org. And they have an article here that they put onto their website July 24th, 2017, Coming to Grips with Oregon's Bike Tax, Local and State Advocacy. And this is by Ken McLeod. And anyway, he talks about earlier this month, Oregon legislature passed a transportation bill that will dedicate $1.3 billion to biking, walking, and transit over the next 10 years, out of a total of $5.3 billion. Now, that's a pretty big figure there. Okay, 1.3 of the 5.3 is going towards biking, walking, and transit, which is kind of a nice thing. The bill includes $125 million for safe routes to school. Very good. Big thumbs up there. And notably, this exceeds the 2% of the transportation package, somewhat fulfilling a key feedback point from our 2015 bicycle-friendly state report card. Unfortunately, this is a great win for bicycling. This great win for bicycling is also paired with a disappointing tax on new bicycles. The new adult bicycles that cost more than $200 will be subject to a $15 flat fee. Now, I talked about this all last week, and I obviously my opinion is pretty strong on this, although my opinions can be very strong. So that's not unusual. But anyway, I am completely against this. I think it sends a really bad message. And reading on into this article, it is obviously the opinion of the League of American Bicyclists, too. Making bicyclists pay, it says here, is not new or novel. Most efforts to make bicycles pay has been through legislation or licensing at a state or local level. Hawaii has required bicycle registration since at least 1988, and with a one-time fee of $15 and a $5 fee when the bicycle is transferred. Many local jurisdictions have registration requirements, including Madison, Wisconsin, which is a platinum bicycle-friendly community, because Madison's like a happening place. So there are places that do focus heavily on helping cyclists out and putting in legislation, which does have, you know, little fees that go along with it. And, you know, there's a lot of there are a lot of cities I know that have bicycle registration within the city. And that's kind of a good thing. If you get your bike stolen, then your bike was registered. And then if somebody finds the bike, you can then find your bike and get it back. So there's some good things about that too. And you know, the other thing that happens when you do something like that is you're handed a list of rules of the road so that you understand that you are a vehicle and that you are to behave like a vehicle. Why don't they do that for cars and trucks every 2 years? Well, that's just another question which we'll get asked. Anyway, should we get worked up about Oregon's bicycle tax? As discussed above, bicycle registration schemes exist, and we have learned to live with them. While not an ideal policy, they can be compatible with local efforts to promote bicycling. They can also be used to discourage bicycling and discriminate against certain types of people who bike. Good point. Oregon's tax is different than the bicycle registration schemes. Bicycle registration schemes, when done well, provide a service to bicyclists who receive better theft protection, bicycle theft recovery. That's something I just talked about. Oregon's tax does not provide any services directly. To the extent it provides service, it provides a service of creating a funding stream associated with bicycle use, ensuring that bicyclists have a place at the transportation funding table because now they have a user fee. The value of the user fee is entirely dependent upon the theory of taxation and motivates transportation-related taxes. A user fee generally is associated with the benefit principle that people who pay taxes should receive benefits. This principle has motivated our transportation investments for years and attempts to tie transportation investments to the funding sources for those investments. It essentially frames the user fee of a gas tax or as a fee for a service that promotes the idea that everyone else is not entitled to that service. So anyway, there, if you read the article, I would suggest that you go to the website, the League of American Bicyclists, bikeleague.org, and you'll see a lot going on here. But I'm going to kind of wrap it up in a bit of a cliff note here and tell you that they are not real happy with it, and the user-free concept is problematic specifically for bicyclists because it's not clear what bicyclists should pay for or how it is possible to efficiently collect a bicyclist user fee. So anyway, and then one of the other things that was mentioned within this is that they're concerned, as I was concerned last week, that this may end up passing on to other states. And other states may look at it and go, oh, look what Oregon did. Look, if we charge $15 for every new bike sale, we can put this money into the general fund. And if we don't even get into what states do with their general funds or, you know, things that are supposed to be in one fund but end up in another fund, I don't even want to get into that because that's just going to open a political wound on me. So I'm not going to get crazy on that. But the point is that the user fee is you know, it's questionable. It's really questionable. And it's great that Oregon has a lot of people on bikes. I love that idea. It's great. They've done a really good job. Their bike league is very good out there. They have a lot of bike lanes. They've done a lot. But why tax? Why tax? It's just going to hurt everyone. And it doesn't need to, because it can be worked in other ways. You can certainly do it in many other ways. So I'm opposed to this, as is the League of American Bicyclists. They seem to be very opposed to this too. If you have any opinions on this and you want to voice them, then feel free to email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Or you can also go to the Bicycle Talk Facebook page and you can leave a comment there too. I would love to hear from you about this. Should there be a bicycle tax in your state? Let us know. Let's see how you feel about that. So anyway, I've been poking around. The other big highlight that has come to an end, and I mentioned this in spin class this morning, is I reached out to my crowd. By the way, I had 10 people in spin class this morning in the middle of the summer on a perfectly good day. Very, very surprising. But, you know, people still want to work out, and this is how they fit in their exercise. I know that at least a half a dozen of those people ride outdoors, but they were inside this morning. So I gave them a killer workout. Everybody walked away with a smile and a lot of sweat, and that was that. But I asked at the spin class, who in the room is suffering from Tour de France withdrawal? And I had about four people raise their hands, which is kind of fun because now I know that people were paying attention, because I preach about it a lot while it's on, and I also preach about it when I'm teaching a spin class. I also will take a particular stage of the tour and I will apply it to the workout that day. So I try to do creative things with the Tour de France because it's a fun thing to do to keep people motivated. So there's definitely there was some withdrawal. So end of the Tour de France. Gotta tell you, probably one of the more exciting ones. And since back in the Laurent Fignon, Greg LeMond days, when there was a time trial that made the difference in the race. And so pretty big deal, pretty exciting. Christopher Froome has won again. This is his fourth win, and he rides for Team Sky. And he finished and completed the, 21-day race in 86 hours, 20 minutes, and 55 seconds. So think about that. That's pretty amazing in itself.
That's a long time to be on a bicycle.
That is a long time to be on a bicycle. And you know what? At the end of it, he looked like it was a long time to be on a bicycle.
He has really skinny arms.
He kind of flails all over his bike. He's not the prettiest rider out there, but no. He certainly has some credentials.
He has some endurance.
Well, you know, he's won the tour four times,
oy vey.
Which is bordering on the record. you know, the what do we got? Eddie Merckx five times.
Yeah, and we don't count Lance because
Lance is out.
Yeah.
He blew it. He blew it. He's out. He blew it.
Because he made did it by cheating.
He made a mistake, so he lost all of his credibility.
Wow.
Both with the Tour de France and also with me. But
that's important.
We won't get into that.
Yeah.
He had lost his credibility with me long before he had supposedly won the Tour de France seven times. But I had to unfortunately pay attention to him because he was an American rider and he was bringing a lot of attention to the bicycle industry. And so therefore, you know, we were all watching him very closely. And then we watched him very closely as he took everything that he did and brought it to a new low. Enough on Lance Armstrong. I can't go there. And you know he has a podcast? Did you know that?
Lance Armstrong has a podcast?
Lance Armstrong has a podcast. He actually does a video podcast.
Can you listen to it at WHUS.org?
No, you can't.
Oh, okay.
You cannot. No.
Oh.
And I don't even have a link to it on my Bicycle Talk Facebook page
and
either.
And you're probably not going to put it there
and
either.
And I'm probably not going to put it there either. I'm going to make you look it up yourself
okay.
and find it. But he has had some interesting things to say. And one of the one podcast that I did watch slash listen to with him, he was talking about the safety in the races, especially this year's tour, because this year's tour had a lot of crashes, and this year's tour had a lot of roads that had not been used for many, many years that were questionable. And, you know, he was also talking a lot about the finish on some of these races. As they're coming into these towns and cities, they're there's not a straight way in. There's just a ton of turns, rights and lefts, and very narrow streets, roundabouts, road furniture everywhere, just crazy stuff. And he was, he would like the riders to be part of the decision as to how these races finish up. And he makes a point. I don't know if it's a point that will be taken seriously or not, but he makes a point that it is ultimately the rider's safety that we're talking about here, not the amount of money that the town and the tour tends to gain from said race. So, and that was his point. So I can't believe I'm siding with him on this, but I completely agree with him. And he's, you know, he talks about like the riders should be unionized and that they should be able to sit at the table and have a say in the way things finish. You know, they complained years ago, a few years back, they put a lot of cobbles in. Remember early, they put all those cobbles in and riders were just going down right and left. They're just all falling down. Now, you can argue with the, well, you should learn how to ride your bike. You know, these are professional cyclists. They should know how to do this. They should know how to handle situations like
this. Cobbles
are
tough.
Cobbles are tough.
Cobbles are harder than dirt roads and gravel and rail trails sand.
Oh, yeah. They're way
maybe
harder.
Maybe they're comparable to sand. I don't know.
No, I think that sand is easier to ride through than cobbles because the sand is at least predictable. Cobbles are unpredictable too because they're, you know, they're lumpy and they're different heights and all that too. I mean, I was out, back in April, I was out in Nantucket and they have all these cobbled streets in downtown and to ride your bike on those was just horrible. I can't imagine considering racing a bike on them. But anyway, people do and they learn how to deal with it. And, you know, the Paris-Roubaix is a great example of the cobblestone, you know, classic day of racing in Europe, and people go to it to watch how they're going to negotiate their way through the cobbles. The cobbles can be treacherous, especially if it rains, because then they're so, these stones have been there for thousands of years and they are so rounded off from, you know, vehicular traffic on them that they're very smooth in some places. And then you add a little bit of water to it and all of a sudden you have slippery, icy, nasty, very tricky conditions. So anyway, that's that. So Lance did have a good point and I think that that's probably enough said about that. There was a horrible crash in the mountains, in the first mountain stage, which took a rider out for the rest of the tour and probably for at least a couple of months because he's pretty broken. He I think he broke his shoulder.
That was Richie Port?
Yeah, Richie Port. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a bad crash, very, very bad crash. And, you know, it was just one of those, you know, one of those things where it was a road that had not been used since the 70s. They had not used it in the tour since the 70s. It was very narrow, very winding. The Credit Agricole team, they all trained there, so there was a lot of pace pushing going down through there because they knew the roads really well. The speed was high, and Richie couldn't handle it. So what do you do with that? Well, you either get better at bike handling or, you know, you don't put something like that out there because these roads also, you know, there's no guardrails. You know, there's just big drops, big drops. So, you know, anyway, moving on. Christopher Froome, first place. Second place, Rigoberto Urán from Colombia.
Rigoberto Urán.
Yeah, there, that way. Lost. Was second by 54 seconds. Very, very close. Now, he had a huge comeback. He had a great race. Very, very interesting guy to watch. We want to keep our eyes on him. He is from Colombia. Boy, do I love to watch the Colombians. They just climb so pretty. They're my favorites. Now, here's the big one. Romain Bardet from France. Look at this. Third place overall in the tour. He podiumed. He's from France. The French are still partying over this. They're still dancing in the streets over this. He is now a new hero for them, and he is a serious potential for the future. No question about that. He was down 220 from the leader, from Christopher Froome. Here's the best part. Mikel Landa from Spain on Team Sky, 1 second behind him for fourth place. How about that? Talk about close finish. And so when they rode into Paris, you know, there was a 1 second difference between the two riders. So Whoa. Someone could have actually won on the, you know, the day in Paris, which is kind of the, you know, the ceremonial day of the Tour de France. So anyway, and Fabio Aru, who I was pulling for, was fifth overall. He is from Italy. He is also the Italian national champion.
Mikel Landa's cute.
And he was down, that's nice, dear. And he was down 3 minutes and 5 seconds. And he just really, he fell apart towards the end. That's exactly what happened there. There were others that were trying to claw their way back in. Alberto Contador tried to get himself back in there. He just seems really tired this year. He tried to race the Giro. He pulled out of the Giro. Tough. And Nairo Quintana also. He raced the Giro. He was second in the Giro. He was down 15 minutes in the Tour de France, showing you that there are only a small number of people in the world that can do back-to-back Giro d'Italia and then Tour de France and be successful with it. And I don't even know what the stats are on that. I think there are those like Eddie Merckx who has won them both. But to be able to accomplish that is you're in Merckx land. You're in superhuman land. The people that really stand out from the crowd for sure. It was a great tour. It was very close at the end. The race for third and fourth was unbelievable. The sprinters, the green jersey, bounced all over the place due to a number of issues. One being a disqualification of a rider. Another one being a horrible crash by a rider who pretty much all but had it sewn up and then just had such a bad crash that he couldn't continue the tour. He ended up having to get rid of his green jersey for that. Unbelievable. Just really, really unbelievable. And I don't know if I have that on my stats here because I don't know if I copied it, but so Michael Matthews is the one who won the green jersey with 370 points. Behind him was Andre Greipel at 234. And let's see, what else do we have here on my list really quickly? King of the Mountains was Warren Barguil from France. And 169 points. He ran away with it. He wore the polka dot jersey. Really, really, really fun to watch. What a great climber. He had some amazing climbs. If you're into this, if you really love to watch bike racing as I do, and you watch this guy when he did his dance and got up into the mountains, he deserved that jersey because he was attacking every points flag there was up in the hills. And he just looked really pretty on his bike. He just looked really, really nice. And I kind of like that. That's kind of a neat thing. So that was where it is. And then the Young Riders classification, the best young rider in the tour, otherwise known as the white jersey in the tour, was Simon Yates. So the other award given to Warren Bigel was from Team Sunweb. He was given the most combative rider classification overall for the tour. And if you watched him attack those hills, if you watched how he won that polka dot jersey, you would certainly agree. So Team Sky was the first place team. AG2R, La Mondiale. I got that backwards. Otherwise known as the old Crédit Agricole team. Hey, watch them. They are up and coming. They're looking real good. They were second place in team classification. They were down by 7 minutes over Team Sky. Team Sky is a machine. AG2R, they are also a machine. I was very, very impressed with the way they were racing. I was very impressed with how they handled themselves. So anyway, those are your first and second place teams in team classification. And so the tour is over. I got to stop talking about it. Now we got to go to the Vuelta España coming up. So, I think that's in August, I believe.
I can look it up.
You can look it up. Okay. You can look it up. I'm pretty sure it's in August. So anyway, the question is, and let's see, the question is, and this is an interesting thing. Seven riders who can beat Chris Froome in 2018. Who can beat Chris Froome? I think he's really vulnerable right now. I think without the team this year, if he did not have Team Sky, that well-oiled machine that they are, if they were not with him, he would have not come close to winning this year. They were very, very critical in the way that he won that race. They worked really hard for him. It was a very good lesson in cycling. If you are a rising star in the cycling world and you think you're all that and you're an individual, can't do it without the team, folks. Pay real close attention to what happened here. That team probably rivaled the U.S. Postal team from years ago as far as controlling the pace, controlling the peloton. It was just amazing what they did, and I give them a lot of credit because they did it the right way. They paid attention. If you are a young team manager or a new team manager and you're trying to teach team tactics to your younger riders, study this tour. Study it very closely because it's all about the team. And a lot of people look at cycling and go, team? Cycling? But it's just like one guy who's like beating someone. No, it's not that. That's just not the way it works. There's a lot of tactics involved. This sport is truly a chess game on wheels. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of positioning. There's a lot of really important things that happen throughout the entire race. It goes over 21 days. There's so many factors involved, and it's all about controlling the speed and controlling the who gets away and going, who goes with them. You know, a classic is a rider will, someone was just telling me about this. He was in a race. I was telling about this earlier this week. And he was in a race and he launched an attack and he got away and a rider from another team came with him. And so he's like looking around. He's going, oh my gosh, I got this thing. I got it. Shout out to Johnny, by the way. And, my friend Johnny O'Brien. Anyway, he said, so this other team member comes with him and just sat in, didn't do any work. Why did he do that? Because he didn't want him to stay away because he wanted his teammate to be able to be there at the finish for the sprint. So his job was to go, latch on to the guy that got away and slow it down and don't contribute and make him do all the work. And that eventually reels you back into the pack and then the game is over. So, yeah, there's little things like that that go on. And then there's the, where you go away with this other rider and you don't have anybody on your team that has a chance in the sprint at the end. So you contribute with them and you work together. And then pretty soon you're on opposing teams, but you're only sprinting against that one person at the end. So your chances are far better than trying to sprint against 100 riders. So it's kind of there's a whole lot of tactics go on. But, big shout out to Team Sky. They did a great job. They really, really did a good job. So 7 riders who can beat Chris Froome in 2018. He only had a 54-second gap. So everybody is really, really close. So the other riders besides Eddie Merckx would be Jacques Anquetil and Bernard Hinault and Miguel Indurain for the most ever. They all have 5 wins. So So Froome's on the way to becoming part of history, and we'll see if he can get there or not, because there are a lot of people that would like to have that spot. Nairo Quintana, why he could win. Quintana was anointed as a top candidate to defeat Froome when he finished second in 2013. He won the Best Young Rider and the Best Climber competitions. Since then, Quintana has won 2 other Grand Tours. He's won both the Tour of Italy, the Giro, and he's also won the Tour of Spain, the Vuelta a España. So he has a chance of doing that. And it says here why he may not win. The Giro and the Vuelta are routes that are often relentlessly mountainous. The climbs are often longer, and what's more, they're sharper. You don't find the 20% gradients of Italy's Mortirolo or Spain's Angliru climbs anywhere on the tour route. Although there were some steep climbs this year, there were some segments of 20% in the tour, which I have not seen in the past. I think that on a positive side of the Tour de France promoters this year, I think they threw in some uglies, that really made it a little more challenging for some of the climbers and made it a little more interesting tour because of that. So anyway, Nairo Quintana from Colombia. Romain Bardet, yes, yes, yes. Let's take a look at Romain Bardet. Like him, like the way he rode, very aggressive rider. He did really well this year. Why he could win. Despite a disastrous stage 20, during which he lost almost 2 minutes to Froome, that was the time trial, by the way. He can't time trial. He needs to work on that. He is one of those skinny little climbers, and he is also very pretty in the climb. He looks really, really good. But he was out of gas, and he had to do a time trial, and he lost 2 minutes. Boom. That's it. Go away. You got to be a great all-round rider to win the Tour. But he is definitely something that is up and coming. He's 26 years old. He's very young, so he's got a lot. And really, they say that the best chance for the riders that win the Tour and win it consistently year after year usually starts right around 26 or 27 years of age and goes up to about 34 years of age. So, anyway, why he may not win? He's historically never been very good at time trials. With 2 standouts in his career, a 5th in the Hilly TT at Megève that Froome won, Bardet still gave up 42 seconds there. So, it's tough. Unless it's a complete uphill time trial. They did the Alpe d'Huez 1 year as a time trial. And that was, that's a good time. It's over 10% at the bottom, and it mellows out to 6% all the way to the top. And they did it as a time trial 1 year. And that was pretty wild to watch. So he might stand a chance of something like that, but most time trials are in flatlands or lightly, gently rolling areas. So he's got a lot to work on there. And good luck with that because, boy, I hate doing time trials. I think they're great for you. I think they're like one of the best forms of training you can do. I totally endorse them. I just hate doing them because they make you push yourself. Well, the reason they're so good is they make you push yourself really hard, and you find out what you have.
Well, it's not your specialty. You're not a wattage guy.
No, I'm not a wattage
guy.
You're
like, climb the hill, go down the hill. Climb the hill, go down the hill.
Right.
You're a polka dot guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. That's definitely, I'm more of that long, lean kind of, you know, big lever guy.
I like time trials.
I do not.
Yeah.
I do not.
They're fun.
I find them very uncomfortable.
No, they're good. They're rush.
Yeah, good rush. Great. The only rush I've ever experienced in a time trial was my food coming up at the turnaround point.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes. So that's how much I appreciate time trials. By the way, that was my very fastest time trial ever in my life when I did that. But maybe because I was, you know, a few ounces lighter at the turnaround on a 10-mile time trial. But no, we're not going to go there. We're not going to go there.
You already went there.
I did. So here we go. So here you go. Rigoberto Urán. How do you say that?
Rigoberto Urán.
Urán. Right. Oh, right. I know. I'm not good with this thing.
Did they teach Spanish in Ledger?
Yeah, but I didn't take it.
Uh-huh.
I took French.
Yeah.
I took French. So anyway, why he could win 2017.
Yeah, let's hear you say Romain Bardet.
Right. There you go. Romain Bardet.
Mm. Mm. It's all right.
Okay. So 2017, second place finisher, Urán. You say Ron, you don't say the U. Yeah. Is that correct?
No. Rigoberto Urán.
Urán. Okay, got it. He was the surprise in this year's tour. He's a strong climber with a solid time trial result. He was the best of the other GC contenders, losing just 25 seconds to Froome. He had success in the TTs in the past, but until Saturday, it had been several years since he put it truly to a top ride. If he can improve just a little bit in 2018, he's a strong chance of winning it overall. And why is it not so good? Age works against him because he's 30 years old. Oh, gosh. So old. That's not that old. Like I said earlier, I have seen Tour de France and Giro winners up to 34 years of age without too much trouble. Maybe it is a little trouble. I mean, Froome is getting there, and he's certainly suffered a little more this year. But it can happen. But anyway, so that's what they're concerned with here. He's been a pro for 11 seasons. How about that? He signed his first pro contract when he was 19. So there's a lot of miles on those legs. That's part of the reason why they think that he might have some trouble. Mikel Landa. Why he could win. Let's see. His climbing support for Froome. Yeah, he was crucial for Froome. He was there all the time. And, you know, I think he rode for Astana in the past. Yeah. And he finished second place. So he's a big deal. He's definitely a pretty big deal. I would imagine that someone is going to try to swoop him up and put them as their general on their team. So if Sky hangs on to him, then, they have a potential other person, but if he wants a chance to win the tour, he's kind of got to get on a different team because he's not going to be allowed as long as Chris Froome is still going strong. And why he may not win, although he's a competent time trialist, Landa won't put real fear in Froome's heart on TTs. After only 2 years on Sky, no one knows him better than his current employer. Okay, now comes a tough one. Primoz Roglic, Primoz Roglic. Why he could win. He is a Lotto jumbo rider, and he admittedly a speculative pick. He is often pegged as a TT specialist, and he is a talented at the discipline with a win in last year's Giro, among other results. He's also a solid GC rider with good results in the hilly long week-long stages like Vuelta and Tour of Romandy. Anyway, so they're kind of looking at him to see that he might be someone in the future. These guys are all pretty young, which is kind of neat because we have some up-and-coming personalities coming into it. Why he may not? His main issue is time. A former top junior ski jumper, Roglic, took up bike racing only a few years ago and his second year in a world tour, but he's already 27. Oh, cry. 27. He's a puppy.
Anyway, the battle will be a steep learning curve to develop his overall skills fast enough to match the physical peak that will come in the next few years. Okay, I understand. He didn't grow up on a bicycle, so that's why they're saying that. So the window just may be too short, too small. But anyway, those. And then the last one on the list. No, not the last one. There's two more. Tom Dumoulin. Now, Tom Dumoulin won the Giro this year. And that's why you did not see him in the Tour de France this year, because he had won the Giro and he wisely said, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm going to stay home on this one. And he's resting, and probably something that Nairo Quintana should have done. But anyway, and also Alberto Contador had a lot of difficulty in this tour. So it's really, really hard to do the Tour de France, but do the Giro before the Tour de France. It's just not a lot of time in between. There's not a lot of recovery time. It's very, very difficult to do them back to back. So I will tell you, this man can time trial. Boy, is he good at time trialing. He won the Giro on the time trial. The time trial was the last day of the Giro, and he was spectacular. He had, although the other riders were very good, and it was Quintana and it was Nibali who were second and third in that race, and they got into a cat and mouse game in the mountains. I talked about this in a previous episode and podcast, and I said that both of those race directors should be fired for not telling them to just kill themselves up there in the mountains, continue to put the edge on, because they had a minute over Dumoulin. And that would have cinched them a first and second, with Tom Dumoulin being third, because even in as good as he was in the time trial was short enough that he would not have caught them. So anyway, he is another possibility. And there's not any real good reason why he would not. He's definitely a strong rider. The question is whether he has a strong team. And also on this list is Richie Porte. Poor Richie Porte. Richie Porte had a horrible, horrible ending to his tour this year. He was taken out. He took himself out, unfortunately, because he did ride off the road, which took him out of the tour, and was launched off his bike at 45 miles an hour into the side of a mountain. And it's kind of amazing he walked away from it. He took Tony Martin out, like, big time. And that's amazing in itself that Tony was able to get back on his bike and stay on the tour. But they did interview him often, and he did say he was very sore from that crash. But anyway, Porte was taken out, and I would say Porte was definitely the strongest challenger. He's a solid climber, and outside of Froome, he's thought to be one of the best time trialists of all the contenders. He was riding in fifth place overall, just 39 seconds behind Froome before he crashed out. And that was among the elite section of riders who go all the way to the top, take the top three spots overall. He also has a strong team and is deeply experienced. So why he may not? Quite simply, Porte can't get past the bad day. In his past three shots leading a team in the Grand Tour, he's had a flat, a crash, or some other mishap that costs him a shot in the overall. Hey, three down, that's it. Three's over. Now it's time. I put money on Richie. I think he's got a good chance at it. So anyway, those are the guys that could probably take a shot at the old Froomster and take him out for next year. So we'll
Froomster?
See. Froomster, yes. And then maybe we can see someone else, maybe someone who is, please, don't take this the wrong way, Chris. If you happen to ever listen to my podcast, you probably never will. But Chris is not a ballet dancer on his bike. He's just not the prettiest rider out there. And I know he gets the job done, and I know he's real good at it. He just has, maybe it's just because he's all arms and legs, kind of like I am.
Yeah.
And he just looks all gangly on his bike. I don't know what it is. But I've talked to people, and they say I look good on my bike. But that's another story. So anyway, we'll just have to see who it could be that could possibly do any kind of damage to our Mr. Froome. So while I was poking around in you know, my withdrawal from the Tour de France, I got an email from a website called trainingpeaks.com, and I'm tied into a lot of different websites, and I have they do power analysis is what these guys do, and they had a power meter on a number of different riders, and they were looking at stage 19, the longest stage, and recovery time for the field. So this was the 222.5 kilometer stage. It was after the Galibier. It was there was a large break of 20 riders that dominated the longest stage of the tour. After being let go in the first climb, after 25 kilometers, they fought hard for the stage and win in the final, while the peloton settled into a very moderate tempo as everyone anticipated the time trial that would follow the next day. Compared to the previous 3 weeks of racing, stage 19 had only one climb, and no doubt a welcome change for the riders prepared for Saturday's final speed test in Marseille. So what I found interesting here is I'm looking, they have the data from three riders, from Yaron, from Nathan Brown from the U.S., and Dylan Van Baarle from the Netherlands. So they have these three different riders. They Yaron finished 46th, and Nathan Brown finished 51st, and Dylan Van Baarle finished 49th. So anyway, the duration of the ride was 5 hours, 18 minutes, and 36 seconds. Their speed was 41.9 kilometers per hour. You can figure that one out for me, Fran. 49.1 kilometers per hour, okay, was the average speed of a 5 hour and 18 minute 222 kilometer stage. So 41.9. So they were moving along, let's say. I would say that's got to be like 27, 28 miles an hour probably, right? Average speed?
26
miles an hour, average speed, okay. Average power on 157 watts. Okay, 157 watts.
Is that a lot?
Any of you who ride bikes, normalized power, 200 watts. So let's say really 200 watts is what we're looking at. Nathan Brown, 209 watts. And Dylan Van Baarle, 234 watts. So 200 watts on the first rider, 310 watts maximum output, peak power output, all right? On the second rider at 209 watts, 261 watt maximum power outage, power output, and 237 watts with a 300 watt on the rider from the Netherlands. I'm looking at this and I'm going, okay, I can hold 200 watts. You know, I can do that. I tested out when I got my analysis, my blood analysis to find out when I go into anaerobic.
Your lactic
my
threshold.
My lactic threshold. Thank you. Couldn't pull the word up. When I got my lactic threshold analysis, I tapped out around 220 watts is where I tapped out. When I hit 220 watts, I am making lactic acid. Boy, am I making lactic acid. So that's my not so sweet spot, you know, when I get to that point. But sure, I could maintain a couple hundred watts for an extended period of time. Could I do it for 222 kilometers? Absolutely not. Could I? that just amazes me. Would I possibly hit 300 watts? Yeah, probably in a climb. I could probably hit 300 watts in a climb. It could happen. I could hit 350 watts in a climb. But the point is, these guys are all, they're all small, thin riders. They are Grand Tour riders. These guys are cut out for riding the long races. They are cut out to climb. They've got those long, lean bodies. Their body fat is beyond ridiculous. Or below ridiculous. they tend to be, well, let me pick an average rider in this one. We're going to pick someone who, there's a rider, the Italian rider who is the national champion. He is Aru. He is 5 foot 11, I think, and he is 144 pounds. Yeah. So just to get you an idea, that's one thin dude.
Oh, yeah.
that is strength to weight ratio is intensely good because he can climb like he looks. He just climbs great. And he's got lots of power when he wants to lay it out. I would love to see how much power he put out, how much wattage he put out when he did that 20% sprint climb and left everybody behind. And I can't remember, it was one of the earlier stages in the mountains, but I would just love to see what kind of power that guy puts out. But anyway, these people are not big people, and therefore their power numbers are going to be low. If you are a larger rider, if you are sporting
Mark Cavendish,
if you're a Mark Cavendish or one of the big sprinters, and you're sporting some extra pounds, and you're closer to that 160 to 200 pound mark, and you're going to put out a lot more wattage, and that's just because of your body weight. So that is going to happen. But anyway, these little guys are putting out very similar wattage to what I can put out. And I was really encouraged when I read this because I got excited. It's like, wow, that's kind of neat.
Great. You could ride the Tour de France.
No, I cannot. Not even close. Because I can't do it at 26 and 27 miles an hour. These guys also, you have to understand, when they're doing a time trial, they're averaging by themselves, all by themselves, they're averaging 30 plus miles per hour.
Right.
So, you know, no, I can't do that. Are you kidding me? Not anymore. I couldn't then. I mean, my best time trial I ever had was I did a state time trial, a 25-mile time trial, relatively flat, not really. It's up in Colebrook, Connecticut, goes into Massachusetts, comes back down. So you there's a seemingly forever rise to the finish. It takes a while. And I did it in 64 minutes. So I averaged 24 and change, which for me was outstanding because that's just not my forte at all. But 24 and change. These guys are doing over 30. So no, I am not cut out to be that rider. I also know after having a VO2 max test done that my VO2 max is of the normal side. So therefore, I do not possess the ability to process oxygen like some of these gentlemen do. So when I got that tested, I got tested when I was 35 years old, and I was relieved that I had made the proper decision to not become a professional bicycle racer because it certainly wasn't my calling. But anyway, so yes, I have the correct build for it. And as our friend Amanda pointed out once to me, to someone from the kinesiology department here at UConn, she said, "Look at him. He looks just like a Tour de France rider." But I just don't have the magic engine. And you got to be able to process serious oxygen to get the magic engine going. And you can improve your oxygen consumption get your VO2 max up with training, but you can't get it up to the levels that these guys are at. These guys are in the 70s and 80s. So, and I am right now in the 50s. So low 50s now, actually, the last time I got tested. So it's, they have a different engine. There's a lot to be said for that. There's a whole lot to be said for that. You take a look at some of these, cross-country ski racers, the Norwegians, who are just so good at cross-country ski racing, their VO2 maxes are, they begin in the 70s and they go into the 80s. They're just phenomenal. They're just their heart and lungs and then legs attached. And they're incredible. That's how they do it. And I'm sure that if you were to test any of the Kenyans or Ethiopians that are runners, they would probably also be in that same category. Now, there are ways you can improve your VO2 max. You could live at elevation.
Yeah.
And that'll help because your body has to learn how to process oxygen more efficiently because you're in thinner air. And you can also train in that, and that will also increase your VO2 max. There are ways to do it, but they're not huge steps. And not to get you up tenfold or more in your VO2 max. You kind of got what you got. You got what you were born with. It's not going to change a lot, but you can make yourself more efficient. So anyway, I was just amazed to see this, and it was just a thing of interest. If you ever want to get your VO2 max tested, or you want to At some point, find out what your lactic threshold is. We have a friend who you will do your lactic threshold test for you.
Right.
And he is the gentleman who is training Fran right now.
Yeah.
And he has the ability to do that sort of thing. And it's just it's either a finger prick or an ear prick is the way it's done.
He did fingers to me.
Did he do fingers for you? And it's painless. It really isn't that hard. Fran says,
It's not. No, it's not exactly pain. It's not terrible, but I mean, he does prick your fingers, and it's not great.
Yeah, it's more the difficulty of the ride that you're doing when you're getting it done, so you get yourself up to that edge.
Right.
So anyway, you can get these things done. If you can get yourself on a list, here at the University of Connecticut is a great place to get yourself on a list for getting your VO2 max done for either free by donating your body to science, or sometimes now I hear they pay for that sort of thing. So you may be able to get yourself tested that way. Get yourself on a list. Start nosing around. Talk to the kinesiology department. Talk to the exercise physiology department and see if you can get yourself in a test. It's cool to do. It's kind of a neat number to know. So check it out. Anyway, we've done it, Fran. We've used up another hour.
Yes, we have.
And so it is time for me to find the bottom of my list here. Oh, my goodness. Look at this. quick reference. The Thread City Cyclers Century is this Saturday, July 29th. And there's a 102-mile ride, an 84-mile ride, a 66-mile ride, and a 43-mile ride. You can sign up on bikereg.com. And you can also sign up the day of the event. It is at Garrison Park in Chaplin, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure when registration
opens. Yeah,
you can
show up there at 7 o'clock a.m.
7 o'clock a.m. Mm-hmm. for registration.
Yeah.
So if you'd like to do one of those rides and learn some of the roads up here in northeastern Connecticut, that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is at the Steeplechase Bike Tour, which is Saturday, August 19th, 2017. Starting with a 5-mile walk and or ride, a 20-mile ride, a 35-mile ride, a 50-mile ride, a 62-mile ride, 100 kilometers, and a 100-mile ride. And that is Saturday, August 19th, 2017. I believe registration opens at 7 a.m., and it is at the ECSU Sports Complex on the Mansfield-Willimantic line. There's a fundraising aspect to that, and the major sponsor of the event has vowed to double pledges for that event. As of last week, they're going to, for every dollar that you may raise, you will be able to realize two. So that's kind of nice. The new Ashford Metric Gravel Grinder, September 16th, 2017. It's the last thing that's on my list. I know there are others. If you are out there and you have one you want me to talk about, please let me know, and I will talk about it. My name is Pedlin Ron. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. You can reach me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you would like to contribute or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedlin Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs.